Thank you, Suzanne and Nico and Doreen and Michelle for this first round. That was really great to have a peek into your daily work and work in progress, actually. Some of you closed, some just opened, etc. Now we will be beginning to talk about a different but related subject on words and concepts. How are we actually addressing things and people and historical phenomena these days in our society, in our ever-changing and shifting society, with new audiences, like you already mentioned, and that's the issue for the next round. And we have three wonderful participants in this round: Jacqueline, Denise, and Carrie. And I'm so happy to have you here all together. You work in a museum, but you have also been working in academics, and you are also connected to the CodeArt features thing, so you're quite familiar with this type of discussion. Maybe, Jacqueline, you can say something about your experience in this connection.
Great, thank you, Franz. All right. In 2020, the Art Institute of Chicago purchased this exquisite painting by Edward Collier, A Still Life, which is among his earliest dated paintings, dated 1662. It was something that we had our eye on and we're hoping to see at the great Tafoff, pandemic Tafoff, early in the year. But I was particularly drawn to it because of the plethora of cartographic material displayed in it. As a side note, I'm not exactly sure that I'm going to address the topic of words, but there are words on this canvas, so we can just like check that right
Definitely.
There. Okay, good. Yeah. And I'm done. And so this is one of Collier's, I think, great contributions to the history of art. And no other painting, to my knowledge, that he executed really captures the breadth of cartographic documents that this painting does. So, for example, the left half of the book that is open on the left-hand corner represents Frederick de Witt's map of the New World from 1660, published just 2 years before this painting was made. There is a reference to Petrus Scriverius's History of Batavia from 1612, and then Jodocus Hondius's terrestrial and celestial globes in the background, dating from the early part of the century. And so in thinking about the Dutch presence in the larger world, I had targeted this painting. How to present it, though, in our galleries is another challenge. For those of you who have been to Chicago, our 17th century Dutch and Flemish collection is what I like to call choice. It is small, but we have some great paintings. And Dutch still life is really not our strength. You see the painting here installed in between a beautiful Claas and a gorgeous Heda, which is on loan to us and will be returning at the end of the summer. So once that Heda leaves, we will have three Dutch still lifes on display. So what to do with that?
But beautiful ones.
Indeed. Yeah. Again, choice. So I was keen to use this Collier as an entry point into Dutch colonialism and the Dutch presence in the larger world. This is not my area of specialization, as you know. So I charged a graduate intern who is still with me, Ariana Ray. She is a student of Claudia Swan. I don't know, is Claudia here? Okay, well, I will say, regardless of Claudia's presence or absence, that Ariana Ray is one to watch. So all of you who will be hiring in the coming 5 to 10 years, Ariana Ray, put her on your short list. And so I asked her to think about a way that we can talk about the Dutch colonialist enterprise in our galleries when the Collier is the sole example of any type of reference to this project. And so she has come up with a template for an interactive feature. I decided that because, and forgive me for going back, because we only will have three Dutch still lifes on display, that the work that the object label has to do could not give justice to the larger conversation around Dutch colonialism. So, of course, the object label talks about the Vanitas component of this painting, about the Ars Longa Vita Brevis theme, but it is the interactive feature, which will receive much more attention from our visitors than the object label, that will talk about Dutch colonialism. And Ariana came up with the brilliant idea of using the rest of our permanent collection that is really engaging the viewer experience and to talk about juxtapositions and similarities with what was happening in the Dutch colonies. So, for example, with our beautiful Habima, she is making a connection to the water mill that was used to produce and refine sugar for export by enslaved peoples. With our genre paintings, she pays attention to the Persian carpet in the netcher, the beautiful and very large pearl earrings that the woman is wearing, the Brazil wood that would have been harvested and used to produce the bow in our Achtervelt that is held by the woman. And so you see some draft text there. This is all I can show you, unfortunately. Our digital team is slightly slowed down by the pandemic, but hopefully by the end of the year, you will be able to experience it, this in our galleries and online. So this is a first attempt at the Art Institute to bring the Dutch colonialist enterprise into conversation. This is important, I think, because it really hasn't been done before, and we are a collection that is visited by international audiences, national audiences, but foremost local audiences. And approximately 50% of the population in Chicago identifies as of color. And so I'm really excited to open up the narratives that we can share in our galleries through this painting.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful to see how you try to integrate older concepts and older ideas into new questions and new audiences as well, and I think Denise, you must recognize something that you've been going through here in the museum as well. You were also in the terminology group, I think, and that was really about thinking about how do we address all these phenomena from the past, and how do we call them, and what words do we use to talk about it, to think about it, to analyze them, etc. Can you say anything about your experience in this connection, please?
Definitely. For sure. The Rijksmuseum has a working group of terminology since 2015, and it consists of me and a couple of my colleagues from different departments in the museum. We'll go to my first slide. Really super short, our process is that we come across a term that is possibly archaic or hurtful, and we as a working group take a look at this term to see if we can find an alternative, or if we suggest to not use this term anymore. So this is the main goal of the terminology working group, to look at archaic and possibly hurtful terminology in our digital collection database. When I first came in the working group, now I think three years ago, I got an easy term to tackle. And this immediately also shows that we are not only working on terminology that is connected to the colonial history. The first term that I took a look at was Lapps, of the people of Lapland. And it was quite an easy one. This was a starter term for me, because it was already quite known that these people prefer to be called Sami or Same, and that actually Lapland, the preferred term is Sapmi. But of course I went through the process, and the first step is then to do research into the term. And what we also like to do is, for every term, is to reach out to the people that actually it concerns. So what we are trying to avoid is that we as the working group or the museum think of terms that is not relating to the people we are actually talk about. So I reached out to a museum in Sápmi, Lapland, and they were nice enough to answer me. And using that information, I made a suggestion to not use the word Laps or Lapland anymore in our future records in our digital database, but use the preferred term Sami and Sápmi. Sápmi is a little bit less known than Lapland, so because of searchability, which is a practical issue, we decided to keep Lapland for now until the term of Sápmi is actually broad enough known that we can also remove that term. Then the next one that I tackled was not so easy. The next word was Creole that I got on my plate, and I think the colleagues from the United States will have a much different association with Creole that we have here in Europe, because all the terms that we are handling are connected to our collection database. The context in which Creole for us was that of Suriname history. So this term was very much connected to our colonial history and also my own history coinciding. So it was very interesting to look at this. And also a very difficult one immediately. And this is one of the other practical things that we come across, that sometimes we cannot do a suggestion for a better term, because a lot of people find the term Creole offensive, the people that it concerns, but a lot of them also still identify with the word. So it's also very important for us to not take away people's assumed identities, because that would, of course, defy the purpose. The next one is one that I didn't work on, but this was leading up to our slavery exhibition. Alongside this exhibition, we had a display also in the permanent galleries called End Slavery. And one of the things that they took a look at with this project was what we were actually saying in our collection database about paintings that are connected to colonial history. So one of the things that stood out was that a lot of enslaved servants, for example, that were depicted on a painting were actually never mentioned in the title. So this is one of the things that they changed with this project. So as you can see here, the title was changed to Portrait of Jan Pranger and an Enslaved Servant, which was before this was not mentioned. And the same can actually be said for women, which is something that I am working on at the moment, female terminology connected to our collection database. And what we see is actually sort of comparable to what I just said. A lot of the pendant portraits. For the women, we often see her name in the title, followed by the wife of husband name. This is not the same for the men, of course.
No.
It is not the man's name and then the husband of. So we are one of the goals of the working group is to really equalize how we talk about different people, different groups of people, different ethnicities. So if we talk about white, we also talk about black. If we name one country, we also name the other country. So we really want to make it more equal and more balanced than it was. And some of the practical problems is that museums usually have quite a large collection, and sometimes it just practically can be difficult because it takes a lot of time to look through all of it.
I was just wondering what this image, how this image relates to what you finally said.
This relates to what I'm currently working on, which is we have another working group here at the Rijksmuseum, Women of the Rijksmuseum.
We're not
going to talk about the other group, but yes. Well, it's sort of related to each other. I gave a presentation about terminology on the 8th of March, International Women's Day, concerning female terminology. So this is why I've added it, because we are now currently looking into how do we call female artists? Do we say female artists? Do we say painter? Do we say paintress? And a lot of these things are again under discussion. So this is why I've added this one as well.
Yeah, very clear. Thank you. Thank you. And Carrie, you are not working in a museum, but you visit a lot of museums, probably.
Yes.
Like we all, although it was a bit difficult over the last 2 years. But you are interested in intercultural processes and the history of gift-giving, etc.
Yes.
Probably more in higher echelons of society. But now also, I think, in textile circulation, etc. Please, tell us something
about
your relation to this issue.
Yes, so I, again, am not a curator, so feeling a little bit like the odd man out here, but I do, and I think we all, and this is one of the many things that we all have in common, is that we spend time thinking about how to translate images into words, and the way that we translate them, of course, is very meaningful. It can be challenging. And I think because words themselves have their own kinds of histories. So today I thought I'd talk just for a couple minutes about two paintings that I've spent a lot of time thinking about, Albert Aycout's African Man and Woman, and thinking about the textiles represented in them, because I think that the names that we give things in paintings, that sort of terminology is can be quite complicated, and you know how we talk about these images, I think, is really quite important. With these textiles in particular, I mean, I'm drawn to them because, of course, the whole series, the amount of clothing or lack thereof in each of the paired figures is really critical to Aycout's perception, or perhaps desired perception, of the hierarchies in colonial Brazil. So when we look closely at these textiles, for me, they seem very particularly painted. He's really careful to record the patterns that he sees here. And so I started asking myself, okay, well, what are these textiles called? Is there any way in which we can identify them? Traditionally, they've been identified as some sort of African cloth, and that makes a lot of sense, especially because 17th and 18th century visitors to Africa and sort of secondary travel literature often say that they see in many different regions people wearing blue and white textiles or trading blue and white textiles. So this association for Aycout makes quite a bit of sense. But the story, of course, is a little bit more complicated than that, as it always is. In the 17th and 18th century, of course, the East India Company is bringing over textiles from South Asia. They're being brought to Europe, repackaged, and oftentimes sent back out to West Africa. And you're seeing three examples of such textiles here. So bajuta pouts, karots, and chelas. These we see on lists all the time, cargo lists going to West Africa. And I think they look pretty close to the textiles that we're seeing in the images. Not exactly, but close. And of course, these are swatch books from an 18th, samples from an 18th century swatch book. So I think that thinking about these garments just solely as African textiles, I mean, certainly they could be, but they could also be exports from India. Now, when this becomes important in terms of terminology, I think, is especially that middle textile that you see, karots. That is often referred to also as something called guinea cloth or guineas or guinea stuff. So it is more like an umbrella term for this blue and white type of textile, although guineas can be different colors as well. The name presumably comes from its intended destination, what the Europeans at that time called the Guinea coast. There's a sort of deliberate coupling of this particular kind of textile with a particular geographic region. But as you can see from the map here, Guinea cloths were distributed really quite broadly in Asia, in Europe, and in Africa. So this deliberate coupling of the term Guinea cloth, which was often described in secondary sources as a cheap material, with West Africa, is an interesting, it complicates the story quite a bit. And I would also say just quickly that there is a long tradition of the production of blue and white textiles in Africa, right? Going back to the 11th century, we see this blue and white checkered tunic that was found at a burial site in current day Mali. And then in the early 20th century, we see patterns of blue and white checks. This was collected by a British anthropologist, published in 1926. And this is, of course, a pattern that looks very similar to what we've seen before, but this was produced in Ghana. It was given a name, of course, not guinea cloth or croats or anything else like that. It was called kotwa, which means the scar, or asambo, which means guinea fowl's breath. This is, of course, all according to Rattray. But these have really, despite their similarities over time, they really have very distinct meanings, and the names of these textiles are really geographically and locally rooted. So I think, I don't know how to translate this all into a museum label, but because it's nuanced, right? It sort of brings up more questions than it does answers. Yes. But thinking about Jacqueline's approach with digital technology, of course, that is something that has been really helpful for our project as well. I'll end it there.
Yep, I think it's another example. And once you dig into a painting like this or these two paintings by Eckhout, and you really start to trying to understand what we're looking at, you got all kind of new questions also. How are we talking about this, and how do we relate to the regions where this comes from? Mm-hmm. Do you also connect to people who are working there or who are working from here on that region?
Do you mean the... Which people? The producers of the textiles?
Yeah.
I mean, that's something we're starting to look into, especially when we see all these, cargo lists and thinking about patterns and loom sizes and what these terms mean, within South Asia, as opposed to when they get translated elsewhere.
Yeah, fascinating.